stand up and be special.
Testing. Okay.
Stand up and be special.
Self-care, mental health, habits, values.
Stand up and be special podcast.
I guess I just start.
Thank you so much for taking the time to listen to the second part of this episode. I know it's been a few weeks since I posted the first part, but as per, life has gotten in the way. Thank you again to Rishi, who came on my podcast and was really honest and open about his struggles with his mental health, and I'm sure that we will hear from him again in the future. But thank you to Rishi.
What do you think is, I guess, in all of that treatment and, I guess, years of mental health struggles, what do you think was or is the most stigmatized element of men's mental health?
Ooh, that's a tough one. I think I'll break that. I can break the answer in two parts. Being psychotic is no joke. Like, you will lash out at people or lash out at yourself, and I think it deserves a stigma because you have to be careful around somebody that's psychotic, you know. And you don't know how stable they are when they're on the medication, but if they're not showing signs of it, then you wouldn't know.
Mm.
Being bipolar, like, a lot of people just think you get really angry when you're manic. That's not really true. You just do a lot of risky behaviors. So that's definitely not a stigmatized, sure. I think male anorexia is the biggest one, maybe not in its stigma, but in its lack of understanding. And 1 in 10 people with any disorder are men.
Mm.
So but about 20%, maybe 25% of people who I meet in hospital are men, and often men have the most serious cases.
Mm.
And I think that's not due to genetic factors, but the simple fact that a girl starts looking real skinny, they go, or a model starts saying, you know, she's vomits and stuff like that. And they go, oh, that's an eating disorder, she needs to do this, this, and this. A girl needs to eat a sandwich, whatever. That's definitely stigmatized. But you see it in a man, and you just don't expect it.
Mm.
You think it's like a woman's disease.
Mm.
It's kind of like the mental equivalent of, like, breast cancer. Mm. And I've lost, like, friends to anorexia. Suicide rate for anorexia is really high. I think that's probably the most stigmatized, I would say.
Mm-hmm.
Because it's just not, even like my parents, like when I told my psychiatrist at the time twice, hey, I've lost a lot of weight, and he weighed me as well. And I was at that point, I was in the 50s, I'm 6 foot tall, so being 50 kilos was pretty light. To be not underweight, I need to be about 62 and up 0.5 and above, and to be a normal weight, it's about 68.5. I'm 72 now, and I'm still lean.
Mm.
I mean, the 50s is really lean. Mm. Like, I know people who are like 5 foot flat and in a 50 kilo range. Mm. I would just please say, like, male anorexia is a big thing because people just don't expect it. Like, my parents didn't really take it seriously. And I didn't really take it seriously until I went to my first psychiatric admission at Northside, St. Leonard's, where they kind of saw me in hospital, and they saw me amongst all these girls, especially who were, you know, just as sick or sicker than I was. I'm not saying my struggle was any harder than some of the other girls' struggles, for sure. I don't believe in, like, really comparing illnesses when you're, like, a similar degree.
Mm.
Like, obviously someone with mild anxiety is not the same thing as someone who's schizophrenic, but... you know, everything is impacting on these people's lives and should be considered. But I was at, there's 4 categories of anorexia in terms of severity, done by the BMI. And I was probably like midway down to the very bottom of the extreme range, which is the lowest you can go.
Mm. Wow.
If I got 48, if I got down to me at 46, like, and I could have had it in like a month, maybe.
Mm.
Like, I wouldn't be here anymore. I would have had like liver failure. I had all these random health problems that old people would have, but like, my bone density was sparked, you know, my hair stopped being curly, went straight. You know, like, it was just all these random things would happen. Like, you just get random health problems. You get like a lot of problems with your heart, really straining on your heart, and your blood pressure and all that. So I think that's probably the most stigmatized one, because it's also the most severe.
Mm-hmm.
It can get very easily to a very problematic level.
Mm. And how did your, like, I guess you've had a lot of different help
and from a lot of different people and like healthcare, etc. But what do you think would be like, if you were in that situation now or maybe in the future, how would someone be able to help you and like reach out for you?
I think I'm a big proponent of saying this, but anyone can do this. Just go see your GP. You got a problem, you can get bulk billing GPs, or even if you go to a fancy GP, it might be like $10 off the Medicare. Go see your GP. You got a problem, go see your GP. And if you got a problem with your GP, go see another one. Luckily, I had a good one because I was scheduled, so I had more of an e-focused one. And I've been very, due to my privilege, I've had a psychologist who's an eating disorder specialist and like a leading psychiatrist in eating disorders in Australia. And I had a lot of support from home and a lot of that. But I have like a friend, I won't say his name, but he lives in like, you know, housing accommodation. So if he doesn't get scheduled, he won't get inpatient treatment. And some psychiatrists will like sponsor. It's like a pro bono kind of thing, people. But if you're not getting the right bureaucracy around you, you're just not going to get the help you needed. I know for a lot of people with anorexia, they go in and out of getting tubed, which is when they force feed you through a tube that goes up your nose and down into your throat, into your esophagus. They get tubed to the healthy and sent on their way. And a couple of months later, they come back and that's just like their life. And then you wonder why they neck themselves. And it's like, because that's not a life. That's not a life worth living. So I would say if I go back, but I was screwed by my psychiatrist. He let me go way too far down. He should have stopped me by the time I was in like the mid 50s. Like, oh, you know, we need to address this, but he just didn't. And didn't tell my parents, didn't tell me to do anything. He just shrugged it off until it, I ended up in hospital again, and he kind of shat the bed and overreacted. And then I was like, no, I need a different psychiatrist.
Interesting. Well, I guess like with anything, you can choose to, like you can choose your treatment. If you don't like a doctor, if you don't like their advice, you can go somewhere else.
Yeah, for sure. I'm big believer like you need to, like from my readings and stuff, psychiatrists and psychologists and GP patient interactions need to be good in order for treatment to be successful. If you don't trust your treatment team, or you don't get along with them, or believe that they have your best interests at heart, your treatment will be affected by that. But it's also on the onus of the patient to try and make it work. But if it's really not going ahead, or you're not really ready to get the treatment you need, it's on you. It's fucked up to say, but when I see people who are like having these issues and say, oh, I'm depressed, or I have this, or my eating right, and I go, look, it's just where we're starting out, and get a hell of a lot worse. But if you're not ready for treatment, that's fine. But if you're not like willing to at least try, there's you're wasting your time, you're wasting the doctor's time too, because there are thousands, hundreds of thousands of people who'd be killing to be in a position where they can reach out and get that treatment and get that help. And you are just like wasting everyone's time. I just think it's kind of selfish of them. I think I've been lucky because I've always wanted to get better. And it's one thing, but when knowing something, when knowing to do something and nothing doing it, those emotions and thoughts get in the way.
Wow. Thank you for sharing all of that.
Yeah, it's fine.
What about now? Like how are you managing now with all of that? Do you have like things that you do like daily or weekly apart from like taking medication and things?
Yeah, I do. I have a lot. So I've tried to really include my mom into a lot of things in my life. And she's been really good with that. She helps me out a lot. She manages a lot of my stuff, you know, reminds me to take my medication and all different things. So I have my five non-negotiables, which is to get out of bed, have a shower, talk to somebody that's not just your family, because you have to talk to them. Before I was going to gym or play some sport, that's kind of been falling off the wayside recently. Get out of the house and make your bed.
Mm-hmm.
And that's a big thing I try every day. I try to keep in contact with my friends as much as possible and go to as many events as possible. I try to include my parents in terms of my organization and that kind of stuff. I've tried getting a job, and that was really helpful. I have like affirmations that I can tell myself. I also have like a big thing for the insulin. I had a meal plan.
Mm-hmm.
So I have like scheduled meals that I have to have throughout the day.
Mm-hmm.
And if I'm not having that, then that's known as like restricting.
Mm-hmm.
And that will lead to a, like a decrease in weight.
Mm-hmm.
So sticking to the meal plan is really important. And it makes it easier when you have, for myself at least, when you have meals that you know you're going to eat every day. Like every day I have 6 week mix of Milo, a banana, a yogurt, and a banana. Usually I like bananas a lot. Lunch is usually like a turkey sandwich, very simple, made some mayonnaise, wholemeal bread and turkey, that's about it. And I have 2 afternoon teas, usually a Milo and a fruit, and then a sausage and shake and a biscuit or something, and then dinner is whatever's done at home. And then I have supper, which is usually a Milo and a fruit. But a Milo can be substituted with like an up and go or a smaller sausage and shake or any kind of thing like that. That's how I kind of get along with a lot of that. But yeah, I think it all comes down to like reaching out, and it's hard to do that. It's hard to be open and vulnerable, especially when you're sober. I'm better when I'm drunk and stuff like that. Hi. But, and just setting yourself out goals and trying to achieve them.
Mm.
I think for me, it was really important. And just trying that all the time, just trying to work towards something. Because once you stop, for me, everything just falls to pieces.
Mm, for sure. I think that's good piece of advice. I like that. I hope you are inspired by Rishi's recovery story and his dreams moving forward. Again, if you are struggling, please don't hesitate to reach out to a professional. And if you struggled with any of the topics discussed, as always, my socials are in the description, and I'm happy to hear any feedback or comments about the episode or my podcast in general. Have a lovely week, and I will speak to you soon.